contaminants by vaporizing acrylic, collecting the residue, and counting it with a high-purity germanium detector. The last few months have been the design of this measurement and actually building the apparatus. So you won't see results today, but I'll also touch on the simulations we'll do to compare the experimental results to simulation. So Snow Lab is Canada's astroparticle physics lab. It's located underground, 2 kilometers underground, at the 6,800 foot level of the Valley Creighton mine near Sudbury. That 2 kilometers of rock provides shielding for from cosmic rays, and we have reduced flux of muons, and those would really just dominate our detectors, and we need to get rid of them so we can look for those very rare and low energy events. The entire lab is operated as a clean room. So after you do your morning commute in the mine, you go take a shower underground and change into clean room clothes. There are many experiments that take place at Snow Lab for its location. There's neutrino physics. Some of the examples are low-energy solar neutrinos, neutrinoless double beta decay, and also dark matter physics. So we've kind of heard a bit of an introduction of dark matter in a few of the other talks. I was just going to mention the observational evidence for dark matter as well. Measuring the rotation curves of spiral galaxies, we find that the velocity at large radii is much greater than what we expect from the amount of matter we can see in the stars and gas. There's examples of gravitational lensing where it appears that a 4-gram galaxy, its gravity is causing the photons from the gravity from matter in a halo surrounding this galaxy is causing photons from a background galaxy to deflect. If you look at some galaxy collisions in different wavelengths, it looks like the baryonic matter is interacting, but there's matter that doesn't interact. So the most, and cosmic microwave background indicates that we know 5% of matter, the remaining is 70% dark energy and 25% dark matter. The most popular candidate right now is a WIMP for a dark matter candidate. And it interacts only by gravity and the weak force, so it makes it very challenging to detect. And in a direct detection measurement, we look for the interaction between a WIMP and matter. DEEP is the dark matter experiment with argon pulse-shaped discrimination. So I just said that we look for a WIMP, chi, to collide with an argon-40 nucleus, and this recoiling nucleus will give a scintillation light in our detector of liquid argon. Single-phase liquid argon, and we use photomultiplier tubes to collect that light. So I'll just briefly show this plot of sensitivity. This is the WIMP nucleon cross-section. We call that the sensitivity for various masses of the WIMP. We compare that to some competing experiments, CDMS, Xenon-100, we kind of saw in the last couple of days. And the projected sensitivity for DEEP 3600 will bring that sensitivity down by 2 orders of magnitude, and we will have the potential for dark matter detection. DEEP 3600 is the full-scale experiment. It's currently under construction. It will be 3,600 kilograms of liquid argon in a spherical vessel. That vessel is made out of acrylic. And I'll also point out right now that we have to put a layer of wavelength shifter on the inside of the acrylic to bring those scintillation photons to the visible range to be measured by our PMTs. And surrounding that are 255 PMTs. We have a prototype that's currently collecting data, DEEP-1. It's just 7 kilograms of liquid argon, and we use a PMT on either side of that cylindrical detector. And this prototype has been good to demonstrate the electronics, process systems, data acquisition, and perhaps most importantly, a study of the backgrounds in our environment and in our materials. So in a search like this, backgrounds are very important to understand, and you must be able to distinguish your WIMP signal from something that's coming from another type of particle. So we put these in two classes of backgrounds. The nuclear recoil backgrounds are from a neutron or an alpha, and electromagnetic backgrounds are betas or gammas from decays. And Deepborn has demonstrated this use of pulse-shaped discrimination in our analysis that's based on the scintillation timing. I have two plots here. They're the same axes. The vertical axis is just a measure of magnitude and time on the horizontal axis. So if we compare this event, which came from a gamma, and this event, which came from an alpha, you can notice by eye that there is a difference, and we kind of quantify that difference by looking at this variable that we call F prompt. So we count the number of photoelectrons that arrive in the first 150 nanoseconds, and then we divide that number by the total number of photoelectrons in one event. And that's for a time of 9 microseconds. So if you divide this big number, by a lot of grass, the electromagnetic backgrounds have an F prompt value of, say, 0.3, low value, and the nuclear recoils will have a high value for F prompt. So this plot is the F prompt variable as a function of energy in photoelectrons or in KeV electron equivalent. And it's, you can see the separation of beta and gamma events and nuclear recoils. And we can separate them, distinguish them, and be able to tell what they are. These betas, the most dominant source is from natural decay of argon-39 isotope that's mixed in with the argon-40. And nuclear recoils are from our materials or the walls, the rock in the mine. So we can cut out electromagnetic backgrounds with analysis, and we can clear out this nuclear recoil area by making our materials extremely clean. And we have a region of interest that we call as background free, because our WIMP event will fall within this nuclear recoil band. This was just generated by a source of americium beryllium that emits neutrons. So I mentioned that materials are very important, because if the container that's holding our target is emitting particles into our liquid argon, then we'll see light from them instead of seeing light from, or we'll be confused that light is from them and it's not a WIMP. So alpha decays are a concern that it's hard to deal with. The reason is that the alpha can cause scintillation, and so can the daughter nucleus as well, when the parent decays an alpha and the recoil of the daughter nucleus. There's scintillation light in the liquid argon, obviously, and that wavelength shifter of a material called TPB also produces scintillation light. And if we have an alpha decay in the center of our detector in what we call the fiducial volume, where we're taking good data, where we throw away all the outside, but in the center we can identify an alpha by its high energy deposition in liquid argon. But if it goes through various materials, or if it's just on the edge and some of the energy gets into our region of interest, into our fiducial volume, then it'll be difficult for us to identify that. We're sensitive to 80 microns deep into the AV, into the acrylic vessel, because that's the range of the most energetic alphas in the thorium and uranium chains. Those chains are important because thorium-232 and uranium-238 have half-lives of the order of the age of the Earth, so they're still decaying, and those chains have many alpha decays in them. So we set a limit of the maximal tolerable concentrations of contaminants from these three, and those are 0.3 ppt uranium-238, 1.3 ppt of thorium-232, and 1.1 times 10 to the negative 8 ppt of lead-210. There'll be inherent contamination in the materials that are used to make the acrylic, but another source of background that is a specific concern is during manufacturing, when radon-222 from the air can diffuse into the materials, and radon-222 quickly decays to lead-210, which has a half-life of 22 years. So when we're running our experiment for 3 or 5 years, it's going to stay there for the lifetime of our experiment. And lead-210 has a polonium decay that goes to polonium that is an alpha emitter. So we need to, if these contaminants aren't volatilized during manufacturing, they're going to be there in the bulk forever. So to assay acrylic, we will first vaporize acrylic, collect the residue, contaminant should stay behind, and then count that residue with a high-purity germanium detector. We'll have to vaporize a large sample of 10 kilograms to get count rates, to get good count rates in our germanium detector. And we also need to get that 10 kilograms to a small size that fits in the well of the detector. So acrylic is polymethyl methacrylate, which is just a polymer of methyl methacrylate, or MMA, shown here. And it has a very unpleasant odor when you're vaporizing, but it's not a concern to, that exposure isn't a concern for workers. But because of that unpleasant odor, we've decided to also incinerate the MMA at the same time, and it will burn in this reaction. So the products coming out of our acrylic vaporization system are carbon dioxide and water vapor. This is a schematic of the acrylic vaporization system. We put a block of acrylic of 2 kilograms in the inside a furnace, but it's first surrounded by a boat of high purity quartz called Supercell, and inside another quartz tube. Then we initiate a flow of nitrogen into this vaporization furnace set at a temperature of 400 degrees. That's because the boiling point of MMA is 100 degrees, so we know it'll vaporize. That then flows into what we call the transfer section. That's just the space between two furnaces. We also have to maintain a temperature of 150 degrees there, so MMA doesn't condense. There's a big check valve, and then we inject air so we can get oxygen for combustion. There's a mass spectrometer that measures the ratio of MMA in air. We need to stay below the maximum flammable limit so we have full combustion. Goes into the incineration furnace at a temperature of 850 degrees. The autoignition temperature is 435 for MMA. And once it's fully incinerated, it comes out and is exhausted to outside of the building. The water vapor is first trapped, so we don't have any blockages in the line. This is a photo of the actual acrylic vaporization system. You see the two furnaces, that transfer section. There's vents where there's pressure relief valves. So we have that check valve to make sure there's no backflow of fuel into this vaporization furnace. And these pressure relief valves will vent outside in the case of overpressure. I said we need to do 10 kilograms, and we do a 2-kilogram block at a time, so we expect a work week to do our 10-kilogram sample. We'll then move into the clean room where we can use heated ultrapure acids and remove that residue from our Supercell boat, and then go underground to use the germanium detector. These are some photos of the germanium detector here with its cryostat of liquid nitrogen and some shielding that the detector sits in. This was made to be ultra-low background. The materials in it should be very clean. It's a well detector, so your germanium crystal is in this shape, cylindrical, and that well is very small, just 2 centimeters by 7 centimeters deep. But because you can put your sample inside of the crystal, you get nearly 4 pi geometry for your counting. And we also have to choose a well detector because it has sensitivity to low-energy gamma rays, and there's one gamma ray from lead-210 that we are looking for. It has high efficiency at that level, too. So we look for a characteristic gamma ray in each of those, uranium-238, thorium-232, and lead-210. And we expect approximately one count per day for each of those energy regions. And we must understand all the other backgrounds to our germanium detector. So again, those gammas from the rocks and the mine walls and materials. So I will simulate the detector. I'm using JAM4 Monte Carlo. And then compare that to our experimental results. To conclude, I'll just say that Deep3600 will extend the sensitivity for direct dark matter detection. We must be very careful to understand all the backgrounds to Deep3600, and these are at unprecedented levels. We've set those limits at the PPT and even more stringent for uranium-238, thorium-232, and lead-210. And we've come up with a method to assay acrylic with this acrylic vaporization system. This is a deep collaboration. I'd like to thank my supervisor in particular, Mark Boulay and Bruce Cleveland. Thank you to funding and for Perimeter.
A couple of questions.
I have two questions. I'm not sure about the refraction index of argon, but do you see Cherenkov light from neutrinos?
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
You probably know that Snow used that method to detect neutrinos.
Yeah, so that's why I'm...
Yeah. Liquid argon won't show that.
How come you don't see Cherenkov light?
From neutrinos from the sun?
Atmosphere.
I don't really know the details, but okay. I just guess that the cross-section isn't what it should be for.
Okay, and do you actually have veto counters? Because, okay, Snow Lab is very deep in the ground, so it's really well shielded from cosmic. But I guess there is still some high energetic muons coming.
Yeah.
Do you have veto counters? And if not, what's the rate of your cosmics in the detector?
Okay, yes, we do. We actually stole the veto counter from Snow, and we use strings of veto PMTs and shielding of water in the same way that Snow was set up. The muon flux at Snow Lab, so I have this number in my head, but I don't know what the units are, so. I think it's something like one muon in a meter squared every 3 days. So it's very reduced because of our great depth, and we have that overburden of rock. But yeah, you need to know what it is, and we do have muon PMT or muon veto PMT.
Okay, so.